Daniel has prepared a talk here. He works a lot with computers, more in the hardware direction, but also a lot of low-level software and firmware, and has prepared a talk on two implementations of Core Boot with two different platforms that he is also going to demonstrate to us. Hi, hello everyone, and thanks for the introduction. 2 days ago I had a bit longer talk about how computers work in general, and today we want to get more into the details. Last year I also gave a talk about the RISC-V processor architecture, or maybe the instruction set. But today I brought two implementations. One of them we already covered last year, and this year I want to go into more detail here. A small introduction here about what exactly is firmware, what is the Orboot project, and then I'm going to talk about the two processors that I implemented and how exactly that worked. And then in the end I'm going to give a bit of a comparison about the different approaches I took, and an outlook into maybe how this could be done. So what is Orboot? Orboot is a fork of Core Boot. So we basically used the Git system to create a new repository, and the first thing we did was remove all of the C code. The first commit was removing all of the C code, and instead we're going to create a new implementation in Rust, which is a fairly young programming language, but is still very well suited to do low-level programming and writing system software. And we use this to try to reapproach this entire firmware. And now I want to talk about what it's like to develop firmware, actually. And I thought about this quite a bit, and whenever I talk to people about it, it's a bit hard to explain. And so I actually came up with a new image for this. So firmware, I think, is like starting to play an RPG. Maybe people that have done this on a computer already might know, in the beginning you have to figure out how all of the functionality of the game works. With pen and paper, it's the same thing, actually. And especially with games on the computer, there's usually a small map included where you can see your environment. And in firmware development, this might be equivalent to the programming counter, the program counter, which is the address where we currently are in the execution of the program code. Sometimes we don't even know where exactly that is, but and we have to find that information somewhere. Then the world map that can be looked at in an RPG, that where you can find all of the things that are listed in this entire world, sometimes even multiple worlds. And we have a similar thing in hardware, which is called the memory map. It's basically a map of the entire memory that we have available. And with this memory, we can, apart from addressing system memory, we can also do other things, which I'm going to explain a bit more later as well. We can talk to the peripherals, for example, SD cards or a serial interface. And sometimes, for games especially, there's a player's guide where there are some hints about things that can be discovered and that should be looked at if one doesn't know how to proceed. There's a similar thing for chips, which is an instruction manual basically, which explains all of the features of a processor and how to use them. Often there are small programming examples for this, which might be pseudocode or it might be C or assembly. All right. But it's also similar to in these games. It's not always publicly accessible information. Sometimes these things are not really well documented, and then you need some basic knowledge about how these things work to actually approach them. And this is also something I talked about in my talk 2 days ago. Unfortunately, this is how the industry developed. These systems have become so complex that some things are very hard to document, and because we would need so much documentation instead of just assuming that the users know some things. And that's why I created another project where I want to create some sort of a compendium for this kind of knowledge. And then there's the funny Internet of Things that many people heard of, which I compare to a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, which might be not just a few devices that we work with, but lots and lots around the world that are all connected, just like us playing together in a role-playing game, and where everybody is running around and you don't really know what everybody is doing exactly. And that's sort of a similar thing with the Internet of Things. You don't really know, are all of these things available right now? Are they maybe vulnerable or being attacked? It also becomes a bit dangerous through this aspect. And now I want to talk about another slide that I already talked about 2 days ago. That's Single Board Computers. I don't really want to advertise any particular product here, but I maybe want to give some purchase recommendations and what things to pay attention to if you want to work with these kinds of devices and have a good experience with them rather than lots of frustration. Lots of single board computers are marketed as open source. Now, the question is, are they really? Just because it's listed somewhere in the marketing materials. This often happens in marketing, where these terms are expanded in the definition, maybe. And that's why the Open Source Hardware Alliance put up some criteria for what makes hardware open source. They say, for example, manuals need to be available, schematics need to be available for all of the PCBs, it needs to be documented how to work with it, it needs to be created under an open license. For open hardware, there are licenses. I'm not gonna further go into them. And now I added, we also need source code, of course, to work with these things. As I already said, instruction manuals can sometimes be a little lacking, especially the stuff that I'm gonna show to you later. But sometimes I often can learn from existing program code that is published. Sometimes I can reuse it, sometimes I might have to change it a bit if I want to use it in a different language. And the more code we have, and the better it's documented, the better we can use it. And if you want to have things certified, then the OSHA can actually, the Open Source Hardware Alliance can certify your open source hardware. There's a form there and the process that can be went through. And now let's look into such a manual.
So this is a memory map. We see the processor manual of the Allwinner CPU. There is a section of SRAM. That's a form of RAM, static RAM. That's just there. I can just use that. I don't need to do anything to be able to use it. And we have 32 kilobytes of that. And in the middle here, in the middle column, we see which address this is mapped to. So we can imagine this as a map. So this is kind of an island in a vast ocean. And there are many sections in memory that are not used at all. And if we scroll down a little bit, we see different regions of RAM, of working memory, and then there are certain sections for general purpose input and output, GPIO. So I can control single pins, switch them on and off, or use them as an input. And I can use them in different ways. And in this particular address range, I can control those. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. So let's look at the Allwinner D1 in more detail, what facts we have. It's an SoC, a system on a chip. It's a single chip that has the CPU and some RAM. And that's the internal RAM. We have periphery, the GPIO ports, for example, and a lot more. This chip is currently in production. There are many boards available using this chip. The CPU has a single core, a C906 core based on the OpenRISC architecture. And this is actually an open source chip, and we can look at the chip design if we want to. There is a second small core, an OpenRISC core, and I can turn off the big processor and only use the small processor for small things to save power, save battery. And this chip was designed to be used in multimedia appliances. One goal was to have very little standby power usage. So the documentation, the processor manual, has about 1,400 pages, and it has a lot of information, but not everything is actually documented. So the DRAM controller, if I want to use memory of many megabytes, that is not documented, and how to configure the HDMI output is also not documented. So here's a selection of boards that you can buy. I added this picture to the wiki. So the one on the left is just like a Raspberry Pi form factor, and a couple more. That is in the form factor of the Raspberry Pi Zero, and the great thing is I could simply reuse Raspberry Pi cases or periphery like displays and button things that I could use with an SI5 chip. And I managed to get this to work and do some demos. Then we have this board here. We can see up above there, these are two connectors. And this connects the actual CPU board to the carrier. And that makes it very practical to develop firmware, because there's a couple of buttons, and I use this to create this demo. The regular dock, if you take off the module, you can add an SPI flash with up to 16 megabytes to add my firmware. Or I can you can store the firmware on an SD card, but with the SPI flash I could add that firmware to it and didn't need to fiddle with a micro SD card. And the Pro Dock has a USB serial adapter and a 16 megabyte SPI flash module. That's this one. On the right hand, we have a USB-C port. That is used for the serial port. So I just connect that to my computer so I can see the serial console output directly. With the other board, I need to connect an adapter myself. And as I said, it includes 16 megabytes of ROM. So when we start a device like this, it has a mask ROM that has the initial instructions that are built into the chip, so we cannot change that. So it is like a boot program on a USB stick, but it's integrated into the CPU. And the code in this ROM then starts looking for SPI flash or eMMC or SD card to see if there is code that it can load into the SRAM, and then start that. And the way it finds the suitable code is it looks for a so-called EGON header in the memory, and the header is not documented, but we found a lot of information in source code, so we could we implemented a very simple code that implements only a read command. So when we boot from a flash chip, then the first thing we need to do is we need to initialize the DRAM. We implement that in a separate repo, and then we added the payloader stage. That is everything that doesn't fit into the SRAM. So, for example, the operating system and additional bits. And this is the first implementation of an SBI. And I'll talk about what SBI is in a minute. So what exactly does DRAM initialization mean? The DRAM controller is not documented in the manual. There was an implementation as assembly dump, and a person translated that to C, and I took that and translated that into Rust. This code is not perfect because there are certain parameters needed. We cannot use all boards with that. And it's probably possible to improve that. So if you're interested in that, then please contact me. We have a community in the Allwinner forums that is actively working on that. So I did my best to document as much as I could, name registers. And if you want to help with that, please contact me, and hopefully we can use that with other Allwinner chips. So we have the current state in the main branch. We can boot from SPI flash. SD card is not working fully yet. SPI is optional, and it's supporting different boards. We can boot different operating systems like Linux, XVSX, and there is also a very small demo that doesn't actually require an operating system, just a little bit of code that generates controls the LCD. So for comparison, let's look at the different chip. The JS7100 SoC is not being produced anymore, but it looks very similar to its successor, the JH7110, and I will talk about that a little bit more about that in a second. So we can probably reuse a lot of code because, for example, the DRAM controller seems to be identical. So we have two cores, two U74 cores, there's mechanisms by which those two cores can communicate with each other, and there is a additional core VP6 that seems to be mainly for multimedia stuff, but that's not well documented. There's very little documentation. There's some instructions to do firmware recovery. There is a small data sheet with less than 140 pages. And but it's very interesting to see where Star 5 actually bought these IP blocks. There are a couple of boards that are available. And the second board was the Star 5 Vision 5.1, because the second board has just been announced. And this is kind of the official board of RISC-V for developers to use. And I did a couple Twitch streams to show a little bit of live debugging, and all of this is available on YouTube.
Okay, and you can see here all of these things that I had to discover for the first time. In between, I always revised this plan that we created of transferring all of the manufacturer code to our own. And this was the basic plan we started with here in the left, with all of the initial stuff. There were some components that the manufacturer had, the second boot, then the initialization of memory, and then SBI and U-boot. Those were the big three holistic parts. And then after that, I converted more and more of that to Rust. That's the little crabs up there. And in the end, there's a little penguin once we implement Linux boot. But we haven't arrived there yet. We are here in this third stage. And this is already enough, because we can already load Linux. What does the boot behavior look like here? It's actually very easy, but not well documented. We can save this mask ROM from U-boot, and it loads a blob to SRAM. And we only have to give 4 bytes of whatever is coming next in SRAM. And of course, it's a bit limited of what fits into SRAM, but we can also load from the SPI flash, and we can use MMIO for this. We don't need to actively talk to the SPI flash, but I can access it as if it were memory. I'll talk about this a bit later. And it doesn't require a lot of initialization. Okay, and this means that in the end, I can just copy stuff from one area to another in memory to load some more code. And then lastly, of course, we have multiple processing cores, so we have to pay attention that we don't run Orboot on both cores, because they might use the periphery in parallel simultaneously. So we actually set one to just loop without doing anything and let the other one work. Now, what does the memory initialization look like here? So I started with this case study, which I also did in the live stream. How does this manufacturing code work? There was some data there about how memory is going to be initialized. This became more than 4,000 lines in the end. There lots of registers are actually documented in the code with comments and everything. And unfortunately, many of them are just magic values written to some registers, and not a lot of explanation of why this is actually done. And I think lots of the code is actually not even necessary and should probably be revised. I also found a bug there where something was written to a wrong register. It was written somewhere where it wasn't supposed to go, which basically was a double bug, which I actually mentioned to them on GitHub. Okay, so what is the development status there? As I said, we can actually continue to U-boot and then start Linux. That works. All of the memory initialization works. And we can also load our own little stage here with lots of C's, for example, that I output there. Okay. Now I want to get to different approaches that we maybe have and that we worked with. The one is how we are talking to the peripheral devices. As I already mentioned in the manual part, there are these blocks, which is basically areas of memory that we use, areas of addresses, and in there, there are the registers of various peripheries, and each one has multiple registers, which are documented in the manual and say what each register is for. A register block is actually just a bunch of registers. Then there might be one for GPIOs, there might be one for the clocks, and so on. And then the beginning of those is called the base registers, and the rest is just an offset to that. So this can then later also be maybe transferred to other chips once this has been done, if they use similar blocks. This is what this might look like. We are defining a base register here, and every further one is just added to the base register. Okay, so far so good. And now memory mapped input output means that we and we can do that by just changing the registers. This can look very easily when writing. If you want to update something, we will read from a register, we do our changes, and we write it back. This might look like this. We can do a read volatile, which is what it's called in Rust. We read the value, we mask it, and then rewrite it back with write volatile. And then there's another approach, which is actually coming from the Rust Embedded Working Group, which is called PAC, or maybe AJL. What is this PAC? It's created from a so-called SVD. And for example, the D1 has a PAC. That's very good, because somebody already did the effort of creating this. And this is basically just everything that's written into the manual. All of the registers, their base addresses, and everything else is written in there. And then you can generate Rust code from that. And we can use that. And now if I work with such a pack, you can see this little graphic here, where I have this peripheral access crate, this pack, and then on top of that I can implement my drivers and then all of the applications. That's basically what we do in Orbu. Those are the three layers we have. We try to keep this very simple, which is why we have drivers in quotes, because we don't really write drivers like that. And you can use these SVD files to create these packs, and that's something that you can find in the documentation. And so if we want to use these packs instead of writing to pointers directly, we will use a semantic function instead of using write volatile. For example, here, if you want to use GPIO, maybe port B, and use it in output mode, and then we set the pin to high, and that's just how we can maybe turn an LED on. And depending on what the API looks like and what the registers look like, maybe I'm going to have a writer interface. There's an example here for how to work with the clocks, a function that I can pass to it, for example. In RISC-V, there are these runtime services, which is something I also mentioned in the talk 2 days ago. And these are defined in the SPI spec and describe the extensions or calls that I can do from a different privileged mode using my processor. I'll not go into too much detail here, but this is also something to keep in mind. This needs to be implemented for each port, and for the D1 port, we have this. And that's why we can actually start Linux, because it depends on this definition using Rust SPI. And now I want to go to a question that was asked 2 days ago, and they asked, what does this look like for RISC-V? Because the RISC-V specification defines that manufacturers can add their own instructions and such things to their processors. And now you can also use control and status registers there, which is a mechanism that is specific to RISC-V, which you can use to expand the features of the platform. And of course you can do this as a vendor, and there are vendors that actually keep this closed and do not disclose these features. It may be required for the full usage, but it can also be that I might not even need them and only use the base functionality and the things that I actually need. I also brought a small list here of three chips that we could use maybe in the future for Orbut. The top one here I think is very interesting, the BL808, which I have a bunch of boards for. It also uses the D1 that I already mentioned. There's not a lot of documentation for this, unfortunately. Then there's another chip that is coming soon, which is the TH1520, which could be very interesting, but it's not readily available yet. Okay, other work. There's a library called Layout Flash that we would like to revive within Orbut. If you're interested, feel free to contact us. There's a framework that we use to build all of the code in Orbut, which is Xtask. It's also used in some other projects. Also something that you might want to look at. And lastly, it would be really cool to also include other processor architectures like ARM, for example. And that's already it. I'm excited for all of your questions. All right, thank you for the talk, Daniel. There are lots of questions here. And this seems to be a very interesting topic. So, first question. Which chip manufacturer is most open source hardware compliant, in your opinion?
So, the first thing I have to say in general, microcontroller manufacturers do a little bit more. They document better. But the microprocessor makers, they're not as open, and for whatever reason, DRAM controllers seem to be a big secret. There is an open implementation of one, and what we would like to find out is any of the vendors actually use one of these DRAM controllers, and. One of the things we're interested in is actually designing hardware ourselves that uses open source hardware designs. So the D1 chip is actually quite nice to use, and the new chip that is up and coming. And I have this little board that I managed to run the first code on this board. That might be also very interesting.
All right. So another question here is: if I have a working Orbut for a particular chip, would this also mean that an entire Ubuntu would work on that if you have the corresponding dongles and stuff?
Well, that depends on what you mean by everything and system. So there is a couple things that are not fully implemented. So we're working actively mainlining everything we have, but the one that is on kernel.org that is not completely integrated yet. And there is a GitHub repo that has a branch that has all the patches. And with that branch and those patches, we have network, we have HDMI displays. GPIO we already have, so I could actually run OpenSUSE. Funnily enough, OpenSUSE, if you look at AliExpress, the D1 Lychee board, so on AliExpress you can find screenshots that I took of my development efforts.
All right, interesting. Yeah, so for the Ethernet boards, can netbooting be done for those?
So you can use the USB port down here on this board. You can use the gadget driver. So I could use that for Ethernet access. So I can access the device over Ethernet. So I can use the CPU via USB and to larger boards that have Ethernet on board. In the Litchi forum and wiki, there are quite a few things that are documented and enlisted.
All right, there's one last question here. Core boot is mostly intended for Intel and AMD boards, and Orboot seems to be directed at SOCs. Is Orboot also intended to be directed at noteboards and such things?
Oh. I'll try to keep it brief. So Orboot is not meant for x86. The idea was to have our own firmware, and that doesn't really work with servers that you have in a data center. And so we had a number of processors and custom firmware, but that wasn't very much publicized. So these firmwares have a lot of firmwares and a lot of systems on a chip, and with a lot of periphery in there. So it basically works exactly the same, whether it comes from AMD or Allwinner, doesn't really matter. And they all do very similar things. And Orboot could be adapted to those as well. So if that is something you would like to work on, I bought a AMD board that I played around a little bit, and I got serial port working. And for example, the DRAM initialization is done by an auxiliary processor, so I didn't need to take care of that. So what we didn't get initialized was PCIe, but if you're interested in that, please get in touch. I know where to find information for that.
All right, great. Thank you. That seems to be it for questions.